And now, our speaker today is Dr. Annie Brewster. We are delighted to introduce someone whose work beautifully bridges science, compassion, and the human spirit. Dr. Brewster is a Harvard-trained physician, author, and founder of the Health Story Collaborative, a nonprofit that helps individuals harness the power of storytelling to heal from illness, trauma, and loss. Her journey into this work began not only from her clinical experience as a doctor, but from her personal experience as a patient. She was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in her 20s. That diagnosis changed the way she saw medicine, and it led her to a powerful realization that while medicine can treat the body, stories can help to heal the soul. Dr. Brewster has made it her mission to create spaces where people can share their health stories with honesty and vulnerability and be truly heard. In doing so, she has helped countless patients, caregivers, and clinicians find meaning, connection, and resilience through narrative. Her book, The Healing Power of Storytelling, is a moving and practical guide to reclaiming our stories, not as passive victims of illness, but as authors of our own healing. We're in for a treat today. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Annie Brewster.
Good morning. I'm so honored to be here today, so thank you all for coming. Thank you, Cindy, for that lovely introduction. I am so impressed with what the Lyceum does, and it's really special to be a part of it. So I wanted us to begin today by just envisioning a ripple together. So a stone is thrown into a body of water, concentric circles ripple outwards, energy spreading, intersecting with other ripples on the water surface, taking on new shape and taking on new energy, and that energy continues. The stories that we share with one another are like a stone thrown into a body of water, with the impact starting at the center with the storyteller, but rippling outwards to touch others. The ripple is powerful. When we create forums for sharing authentic, vulnerable stories and community, we're creating sacred spaces for individual and collective health. And this is what I want to talk to you about today, because this is my passion, and also because I really believe in my heart that we need to create such spaces now more than ever before. So I am the founder and director of Health Story Collaborative, as was said, a nonprofit based in Cambridge, Mass, that's dedicated to using storytelling as a healing tool. And was also said, it grew out of my lived experience of being a patient, living with multiple sclerosis for over 30 years now, and as working as a doctor, and really as a response to what I feel is broken in the healthcare system today, namely not enough time and space for the stories of people's lives, which I feel is most important to healing. Our work at Health Story Collaborative is centered on creating forums for story sharing among individuals who are navigating health challenges. So we work primarily with patients, but also with patients' loved ones and with healthcare providers. And we believe that this work is empowering and potentially transformative, both individually and collectively. We have a very broad definition of illness and healing at Health Story Collaborative, and I think that's important to say at the outset. So we define illness as any imbalance in physical, psychological, or spiritual well-being, and healing as moving back towards balance and wholeness. So the tools that we use are very applicable to many things beyond healthcare. So life transitions, illness, trauma, loss, and other big moments in our lives. So my goal for today is really to share with you some of what I've learned over the years doing this work about the art and science of storytelling for health, and share some of the tools that we use at Health Story Collaborative, really with the hopes that you will be inspired to engage with your own stories, to apply some of these tools, and also to share your own stories in community, because I think that really brings us together. I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about my story and how this work came to be. So I started medical school relatively late, as these things go. I was 27. I had long been sort of pulled towards the field of healthcare, but I resisted, in part because my father was a physician and I didn't really want to follow that same path, but that's a story for another day. But I kept feeling that tug back towards healthcare, recognizing what a privilege it is to be a health provider, to be invited into the intimate stories of people's lives, often in vulnerable turning point moments. So I ended up going to medical school. Medical training is very meaningful in lots of ways, but it's also challenging and difficult. We're tasked with learning a new language, essentially, with assimilating a tremendous amount of new information, and really taking on a new identity, that of sort of health provider or quote-unquote expert. There's even a ceremony in the first, very beginning of medical school where you put on the white coat for the first time, the white coat ceremony, which is, again, quite meaningful, but it does sort of foster this us versus them mentality, with the us being the providers and the experts and the them being the patients. But then I became one of them. So when I was in my internship year of residency, which in many ways is the hardest year, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. So it went like this. I developed a tingling in the bottom of my feet, and I ignored it, and then it started to ascend up my legs, and I ignored it. The power of human denial is impressive. And I ignored it until it really climbed up to sort of my mid-abdomen, and then I thought, I guess I better bring this up with my doctor. I ended up seeing my primary care doctor, went down the path of having a lumbar puncture, otherwise known as a spinal tap, and an MRI, and indeed, there was one lesion on my spinal cord at the T10 level. I was referred to a neurologist, a very well-known, respected neurologist with his name on almost every research paper, but it was a terrible experience. I was alone. I remember waiting what felt like hours to be seen. I then felt like I was with him for no more than 10 minutes when he told me without any preamble that I almost certainly had multiple sclerosis and I should start taking the disease-modifying therapy immediately, which is no small thing because they are immunomodulators, meaning they alter your immune system. And I was thinking, how can he be sure I only have one lesion and it's supposed to be multiple? Well, it turns out he was right, but I couldn't take it in that moment. And I felt like he didn't leave any room for maybe. He didn't ask me anything about me, and I was, you know, a medical resident at the time. I had a two-year-old. I was actually going through a divorce. I was someone who had been an athlete. My body had always worked for me. And as naive as it sounds today, I was someone who'd been able to persevere my way through any challenge that had been set before me to that point. And so I thought, me, a disease with no cure, no way. And I put my head down, and I just decided that I was going to finish residency and go forward. And I didn't see another neurologist for close to 5 years. I really just parked it to the side. I barely even contemplated the possibility myself, and I hardly told anyone else. I kept it very secret, telling only my closest friends and my loved ones that it was even a possibility. And I was really living in a fragmented way, like rejecting a part of myself. But I pushed on. I finished residency. I went out into primary care practice. And I'd been drawn to primary care because of the promise of knowing my patients well, longitudinally, knowing the context of their lives, having deep, meaningful relationships. And in fact, it was sort of soul-killing because it felt really impossible to develop the relationships that I wanted and to be with my patients the way that I wanted to be. And that's because, in part, I inherited a practice, but also because I was paid on productivity, so I was reimbursed more for the more patients I saw. I was penalized financially if my patients didn't show to an appointment and I had a hole in my schedule. The corporate side of medicine was really taking over the relational aspects of care and almost setting patients and providers against one another. So what is supposed to be a therapeutic alliance almost felt antagonistic because we had different demands upon us. The providers were feeling rushed, put upon. I had 20 minutes for my full physicals. I worked in a women's health center. That could mean talking about diabetes, depression, high blood pressure, doing a pap smear. It's not possible in 20 minutes. So always were under the gun. And the patients, of course, were feeling unseen and unheard and not getting what they needed. And I think since then, it's even gotten worse with the corporate side of medicine becoming more intense. But I felt a lot of pain from that because I was supposed to be a healer, but I often didn't feel like one. And I started to think then, this is broken, and how can I make this better? And I knew I wasn't going to be able to change it in the exam room because the hospital was controlling the business side of things, and I'm not a business person. But the wheels started turning. How can I do something better? And then my own experience as a patient really also drove home the point even further that the system was not serving patients the way it needed to be. During this time, I started to evolve in my acceptance of my own diagnosis. I started to realize that if I was going to live my best life, if I was going to live with optimal health, I had to accept this diagnosis as part of me. Initially, I think I'd been terrified that the diagnosis of MS would become synonymous with my identity, that I would be sort of seen as a sick person and it would take over, and no one would see me, Annie. And what I started to realize is that I had to learn to make friends with it in a way, because what was my alternative, and to accept it as part of me, but not all of me. And storytelling really helped me to do this. So I started to share more with others, but I also started to write publicly about it. And it was such a relief just to step fully into myself and to own all the parts of myself. And I recognized that that was very healing. So it helped me find a new purpose in a way, individually, but also professionally, that I needed to help my patients in a different way. Professionally, I'd also started to recognize that the things I thought were true about being a provider weren't true. For instance, diagnosis is not the end of the story. So sometimes as healthcare providers, we are tasked with coming up with the diagnosis, like detectives. We're supposed to solve the problem, come up with a treatment plan, and then in some ways we feel the story is over. But what I learned as a patient is actually when the story is just beginning. You get a life-changing diagnosis, you walk out of that exam room, and there is no way you have integrated any of it. And it takes a lot of time, and it's a process that takes care. And that really, I didn't learn until I was a patient myself. And I recognize that the healthcare system is not set up to help people with this piece of integration. I also learned that sort of this us versus them mentality is wrong. As healthcare providers, we're often taught that we should be very boundaried, not tell too much about our personal lives, not get too emotional, or we might not be able to think rationally, which is not true. And while boundaries are, of course, very important, and we never want to burden our patients, I can tell you that I have become less boundaried as a provider since I've been a patient. And that's in large part because I really value it when my providers allow themselves to be human with me when I'm sitting on the patient side. And then I finally learned that healing is not the same as curing, and that healing can happen even when healing can't. So I started to think, how can I bring some of these lessons to help my patients or other patients like me? And with this process really of integration and identity shift that is inevitable when you get a life-changing diagnosis. And I thought about when I had first been diagnosed, and the thought of going to a support group was absolutely out of the question. I did not feel I owned this identity yet, and I was terrified I would get sort of swept up into some sort of negative vortex. I couldn't even think about going there. But I knew that I was yearning for stories of other people who'd been given a diagnosis like mine that was changing their lives, either a chronic illness or a life-threatening illness or even an acute crisis that requires long healing. I wanted to help people. I wanted to hear from others who'd navigated that. And I didn't want like stories of miraculous cure. I wanted stories of possibility and hope. I wanted to hear how had people moved forward despite the challenges in front of them. Why do some people hold on to gratitude while others become bitter? How can we shift our identity and learn from these challenges in a way that can allow us to help others? And so I decided to start recording patient stories and to create a library so that other people like me could listen from the privacy of their home online. This was the early 2000s, so there wasn't a lot of stories online like this at the time. Now there are, but I didn't want just media sound bites. I wanted true narrative arcs, true stories that were authentic and not just glossed over and everything was fine. I wanted to hear about the struggles, but how had people gone forward? So I had someone in radio come over and train me how to audio record and how to audio edit, and then I was lucky to develop a relationship with our local NPR station in Boston, WBUR, and we developed a series called Listening to Patients. And it was through this work that I learned that there is tremendous healing power in storytelling, both for the storyteller and for the listener. So to engage with the people who are sharing their story and to give them a platform to be witnessed in the sharing by others, to find a sense of agency and meaning in their stories, and then for others to be able to listen and be invited into that was very powerful. And so this was the beginning of Health Story Collaborative. And in 2013, we officially became a nonprofit. Initially, when I started to bring this back to my hospital setting, I work at Mass General, to try and integrate some of this programming, I was met with resistance. In some ways, again, a talk for another day. There's a very strong risk management framework in healthcare, and sometimes anything new that pushes against that is not fully accepted. But it was also that there was this call for data, like, where's the data? Show us that this is meaningful. And I, at that point, had learned just experientially and intuitively that this was very meaningful to people. But I'm a doctor and everyone wanted the data. And I sort of felt like, well, if I was an artist bringing this, no one would be asking me for the data, but okay. And I felt sort of put off because I thought, I'm not trying to study people. I'm actually trying to provide a service in an applied way to help patients engage with their stories. And I'm not trying to study them. It almost felt exploitative to be measuring things. And not everything is measurable, in fact. There are many benefits that we can't measure. And I was very resistant. But initially that fell away because I met my colleague, Jonathan Adler, who's been involved with Health Story Collaborative almost since the beginning, and he's our chief academic officer. And he is a psychologist who studies the health benefits of storytelling. And he has taught me so much that I want to share with you today. One thing that he says is that this is a bottom-up science rather than a top-down. So in top-down, we're taking a hypothesis, we are imposing it on something and trying to prove it. And there's value in that, of course, but I love this bottom-up approach, which is looking at the messy stories of people's lives and seeing what emerges and looking for the themes and the connections and then making sense of it that way. So he taught me a lot, and I'm going to share some of that with you today. Before I get into John's work specifically, I'll say that just we are learning more about neurobiology of storytelling, and at the very basic level, like our brains are wired for storytelling. So it is how we make sense of ourselves. It's how we make sense of others. It's how we make sense of our world. There is converging evidence across many disciplines, psychology, philosophy, evolutionary biology, that storytelling is sort of our human adaptation. So as John Adler, my colleague, says, like, beavers build dams, spiders spin webs, humans tell stories. It's what we do. And there is evidence that, yes, we remember information better when it's told in story format rather than just lists of facts and statistics. And we are more convinced by stories. So there have been studies in courtrooms looking at juries. Are they more convinced by stats and numbers and facts or stories? Well, stories win out. So it's what we do and it's how we make sense of things. To talk a little bit more about John's work, which is this field of narrative psychology, it really relates to sort of the individual healing, how engaging with our own stories and editing them in a way is good for our mental health. So the premise of this field is what's called narrative identity. So that's really the belief that who we are, our identity, is shaped by the stories that we tell about ourselves in this continually evolving process. And it turns out, you know, what shapes this narrative identity? It's not just stories. We don't tell stories about every little thing that happens to us. It tends to be the deviations from the norm. So the standout moments, the high points, the low points, the turning points. And these moments are what we remember and tend to be the scaffolding of our narrative identity. So sometimes we create those experiences, for instance, vacations. There is research showing that we have more memories about vacations than other things. Sometimes these things happen to us, like positive serendipities or something like illness, which is something that we don't invite, but it's a standout moment and it becomes part of our scaffolding. Our narrative identities are stable, but they're not static. So at any given moment, our narrative identity is shaped by sort of how we're remembering the past, how we're experiencing our present, and how we're envisioning our future. And it's this continually evolving process. Sociologist Michael Burry has talked about illness as a biographical disruption. So it's something that interrupts our story and forces us to tell it differently, to rejigger it, to edit it, which is hard and challenging, but also an opportunity. So I'm not someone who says, I'm so glad I got MS, or I'm, you know, other people, isn't it such so lucky you had this cancer diagnosis to learn? No, it's not like that. It's hard, it's challenging, but it's also an opportunity for a new beginning. And I try to remember that. The other thing in this field of narrative psychology is that not all stories are created equally when it comes to promoting mental health. So some stories do a better job at promoting well-being than others. And it turns out it's not so much about the events that happen to us, it's more about the meaning we make out of the events that happens to us. And we play a very active role in that process. So something that John Adler always says that really resonates with me is that we sometimes forget that we are, in fact, the narrators of our stories as well as the main characters. We sometimes forget that we're the narrators. We think we're just the main characters. But we play an active role in deciding what story to tell, how we're going to tell it, where we're going to put the chapter breaks. So we do play an active role in that process. It turns out when you really look into the research, what comes up as sort of what's most connected to positive mental health are themes in the story. So there are many narrative themes that are linked to positive mental health. We hone in on a few specific ones at Health Story Collaborative that have the most robust science behind them, and I'm going to tell you about those today. So one is the theme of agency. So that's feeling like you're in the driver's seat, like you have some control over your story, you're not just being batted around by fate. That's associated with positive mental health. Another is communion. That's when themes of connection come up, relationships and stories. That's associated with positive mental health. Redemption is another one. That's when we see movement in the story. It's really about the movement. When something starts bad and ends good, that's redemptive, and that's good for us. The opposite of that is contamination, so something starts good and goes bad, and that's bad for our mental health. And we love redemptive stories in our culture, and not everything's redemptive. Sometimes we don't have redemption, but there can be redemptive threads. Another one is coherence. So just the process of, at a given point in time, pulling all the different stories of your life together, putting them together in a whole that makes sense to you and to others, that's good for your mental health. And then the final is called accommodative processing. And this is really about meaning making. It's really my favorite. And it's about when something happens to us, we can make sense of it in one of two ways. We can either do assimilative processing, we assimilate it into our existing story, and we move forward. Or we have to do what's called accommodative processing. Something like illness happens, and we can't just assimilate it. It's too big. Our story has to change. And again, that's an opportunity as well as a challenge. And even when in a story you don't have redemption, you always have accommodative processing. So I think it's important to say that, like, we're not always saying we want to look for just rainbows and butterflies. No, but to get this healing benefit, you actually have to engage with the hard parts and to dig into the meaning, and that's an essential part of it. And then I'll say also that there is other research that I don't have time to get into today on sort of physical health benefits of engaging with our own story. It's less robust science, but it's there. I wanted to play a clip. I'm going to play some clips of people I've worked with over the years just because I think they're so amazing and they continue to inspire me always. The first one that I'm going to play is a clip of Evelyn Berde, B-E-R-D-E. I spell it because I want you to go look at her artwork later. She's a storyteller, she's an artist, and she has worked with me as part of the Listening to Patients series I did years ago at WBUR. And in this clip, she's talking about a painting that she painted, but also an experience she had at Mass General Hospital when she was 7 years old. So she is somebody who was born with congenital scoliosis. She spent lots of time in the 1950s at Mass General undergoing what some of us today might think are barbaric procedures, like being in traction with weights attached to her head and to her feet for months at a time, the body casts, multiple surgeries. And this clip takes place in what's the Ether Dome at Mass General, which is famous, some of you might know, for where ether was first demonstrated in the 1840s as an anesthetic tool, and it's where a lot of meetings with doctors happened. So this one is the longest of the clip I'm going to play. It's 4.5 minutes, but I think it's important for us to listen collectively to Evelyn, and I just think she's amazing. So we're going to take that away, so let's listen.
Going back to when I was a little child, I had a series of casts every single year. And when I was 6 years old, 7 years old at this point, I had my cast taken off because the next day I would be having surgery, my first spinal fusion and a young doctor came in to my bedroom. It was a ward, and so he got me out of my bed and put me into a little go-kart and said, "We're going to go for a surprise. We're taking you for an adventure." And I said, "Oh, are we going to go to the gift shop?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Well, are we going to go for something to eat at the cafeteria?" "No, I'm not telling you." And so we passed by the library and the playrooms in the hospital, and I kept thinking we were going to go to all these different places, but we just kept passing them by. And I knew Mass General very, very well because I've been there so many times. So I didn't recognize where we were going. So we finally got to a place, and he parked me outside of a door and said, "I'm going to take you in that door in a minute, and I'll tell you the surprise." All I had on was a Johnny and a tiny little pair of pink underpants that somebody had given me with ruffles on the back. I'll never forget the ruffles on the back. And so he wheeled me into what is the Ether Dome at Mass General. All I remember was I saw a sea of faces in rows going up, 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 really high in front of me with lots of people with white coats on. And they looked lifeless and gray because I couldn't see anybody's color of their skin or if they were a man or a woman. They all looked very similar to me, but their eyes looked like they were scary and sad and trying to figure me out. And the doctor that was on the stage was the director of the orthopedic department, and I had never met him before. And so he stood me in front of him under a light, and on the wall there were x-rays of my body from the floor to the ceiling. And in this painting, I've got lots of images of deformity, pictures of Quasimodo from Hunchback of Notre Dame. As a child, I saw the movie on television in black and white, and I didn't know why people were so afraid of the Hunchback of Notre Dame. And I remember my mother saying, "Well, he's got scoliosis like you do." And all I remember is how scared everybody was of this person's deformity and that he would be thrown always back up into the bell tower in the town. The name of the painting is Shame, because I don't ever remember feeling more ashamed of myself and my body and my person, my soul. I felt like I was an object. I didn't feel like a person. I felt betrayed by the doctor who had brought me there. I didn't know why this was happening to me. There are words in front of all the doctors, words that I cut out from medical books about scoliosis from the 1950s. Words like disorders and deformity and radiation and trauma and all kinds of words that I found that were said about me and around me a lot. And again, the faces of these people, some of them just looked horrified, or I felt like they looked horrified at me. And the person on the stage pointing to me just kept talking about how much they would try to fix me, and they would do the best that they could to fix me. And so that's pretty much the theme that I had all growing up, was trying to be fixed. Many, many, many years later in my life, after this happened, as an adult and as a person that gives lectures about healing and art, I was asked to give a lecture at Mass General. And so I said, yes, I would. And they said, "Oh, we're going to hold it in the Ether Dome. I don't know if you've ever been there." And I said, "Perfect, perfect." And so I went back to the Ether Dome with this painting and spoke to the audience there as a strong, clothed woman, somebody that had clothes on that was facing them, not my back to them, but my whole full presence was there. And I was able to stand and tell them my story and the story of this painting. To go there was such a healing experience for me. And I left there feeling like a major piece had been put into the puzzle. It was just really a finishing piece. It was great.
Amazing. So, if you would like to see more of her artwork, you can either go to the Health Story Collaborative website. If you put in Evelyn Birdie, you'll see her talking about some of her other paintings, or you can go to her website, evelynbirdie.com. I just think she's a miracle. And I love that we see a lot of these themes in this story. Just this short clip, we see redemption, for sure. We see agency. We see accommodative processing. We see coherence. So I think she's just an example. And also to say that all of these themes, none of us have all agency, or we always have a mishmash of these different themes. And when we're working with people at Health Story Collaborative, so one of our programs is called Healing Story Sessions. They're live storytelling events where we usually have two storytellers come forth and share in front of an audience in person, or since the pandemic, also we do them online. And we work with people in advance through writing, but people, we've also done it with people who aren't literate, so we can do it orally, to write their stories or tell their stories using a narrative guide that's grounded in the research. And then we are working to sort of tease out these themes to show people where they already exist and to explore and examine them and expand them further. And so it's really about asking curious questions. We don't necessarily even name the themes, but we are helping people to explore. These, usually the storytellers are linked by either a diagnosis or maybe by a theme. So for instance, we've done events with parenting with life-threatening illness, or by relationship, we've had a kidney donor and a kidney recipient, for instance, or a mother and a son, the mother with metastatic melanoma, the son a medical provider, but navigating that, because also it opens up new conversations in relationships when these things happen. So that is the work that we do really around trying to pull for these themes. Always in the audience, there's an element of collective healing that's essential to this process. So when two people stand up, or one person, anyone stands up and shares vulnerably, it creates an opening for others. It gives people permission to engage with their own vulnerability and to go deeper and to look inside. And some magic can happen when you are collectively together and this happens. I like to think of storytelling as a relational act. So when I tell you my story, how you react to it might alter the way, even in a tiny way, how I tell it next time. Maybe you hearing my story might alter your story in a tiny way, and so on and so on and so on. And it's this ongoing dance of us engaging and learning from each other's stories. There is evidence that there's value in being listened to by an empathic witness. So there are studies that have looked at healthcare providers and patients, and those that perceive of their providers as empathic actually do better on all sorts of fronts. So shorter duration of symptoms, less severe symptoms with the common cold even, less complications with diabetes, less physical pain, less emotional distress, better diagnostic accuracy, deeper relationships, better communication with your provider, and so on. So being an empathic witness has power to help people. We're learning more, as I said, about neurobiology of storytelling, and there's something sort of instantaneous that goes on the neural level when you're with someone in an attuned relationship, being listened to and listening, this back and forth. There have been studies between psychotherapy patients and their clients looking at measuring actually autonomic arousal by heart rate and skin conductance, which is really a measure of sort of emotional reactivity. And what they found is when the patient and the provider were synced up, sort of concurrent in their values versus discordant, the patient was much more likely to perceive of their provider as empathic. So there's just something magic that's happening in our brains at the very instantaneous level. There's also value for the listeners on the listening side. So we know there's a lot of research these days about isolation and loneliness being bad for us on a lot of physical and mental health levels. And support groups and connection is good for us. So we know that. But more specifically, there are studies that have looked at individuals like living with chronic illness, for instance, diabetes and high blood pressure. And those that listen to stories of other people living with conditions like theirs, navigating them, do better on some levels, emotional engagement-wise, and self-care, like better exercise, better diet, better communication with providers. But also, there was one study that looked at a group of people who had very difficult to control blood pressure. Some of them heard stories of other people living with difficult to control blood pressure from their same communities, and others that didn't have that, but they were controlled on all other fronts, and those that heard the stories did better in terms of their blood pressure numbers. And then there's been studies. One example is looking at hospitalized children. Some heard stories, some played a riddle game, so they were engaging with humans for the same amount of time, but the story group did better in terms of using more positive words to describe their hospital experience and having less physical pain, and also lower levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone, and higher levels of oxytocin, which is a hormone that's associated with empathy and connection. So we do know that then it makes a big difference. I mentioned at the outset that we also use storytelling for promotion of social change, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about that. So I said before that stories do a better job convincing people, helping people across difference communicate much better than facts and statistics. There was a 2021 study that looked at 15 different studies, a meta-analysis, and it found, like, on hot-button moral issues like gun control, same-sex marriage, abortion, people were much more likely to perceive of their opponent as rational and true than if they were told information in a story format rather than facts and statistics. So it's how people see across the aisle. I wanted to, before we go more into the social change, and I want to tell you about our program, I want to play another clip that just highlights the collective piece. And this is Michael Bischoff, who is just an amazing man who unfortunately died of a glioblastoma, a very aggressive brain cancer, in 2020. But he did a story session with us and his provider, his oncologist. And this is just a tiny clip from that. It's 2 minutes. So let's listen to Michael.
I have an aunt who lives in Indiana. Aunt Marcia. Maybe Aunt Marcia's watching. And Marcia said, she felt inspired to every day when I was doing chemo, send me stories. Stories of other people in our family who experienced challenges and found grace in those challenges. And one story she told me was about my great-grandmother, who I met and really appreciated when she was alive, but I'd never heard this story from her. My great-grandmother had a daughter named Mary Esther. And when Mary Esther was a toddler, she was very sick. She took her to the doctor. It was an obstructed bowel. And the doctor said, I can't do anything for her. My great-grandmother was at home making dinner, and Mary Esther came over and tugged on her apron and said, Mama, can you rock me? My great-grandmother picked up Mary Esther. She rocked her, she sang to her, and Mary Esther died in her arms. So Marcia's telling me this story, and she adds to that that when my great-grandmother was dying, Marcia was there next to her, and asked her, could she hold her the way she did for her daughter when she died? And Marcia said, that was one of the most euphoric things in her life. And my great-grandmother and Mary Esther and Marcia started teaching me that healing and dying sometimes go together. They're not enemies.
So I love that story, well, because I love Michael, but also I love that it's a story within a story, but also that he just reminds us that there's healing in the giving and the receiving, and that, again, even when we're dying, there can be healing that can go on. So to the social change piece, I talked about our individual narrative identities, and it is very important to me that we take charge of our own stories, but I'll say that it's important to acknowledge that no story exists in a vacuum, right? So we live actually in a web of broader dominant cultural narratives that impact our narrative identity. In the research, these are called master narratives. We all have multiple, that of our home life, that of our work, that of our ethnicity, whatever it is, and we are always in negotiation with them. And these master narratives tend to privilege people that fit neatly within them, and they're harder for people that don't fit neatly within them. And the way to promote social change is really to put forth more individual narratives that push against these dominant master narratives. And that's how we move the needle. And it's hard to do, it takes time, but it's possible. So one of our programs at Health Story Collaborative is called The Opioid Project, Changing Perceptions Through Art and Storytelling. And for this, I love that I get to work with a visual artist, Nancy Marks, and we run four-hour workshops for people who've been touched by the opioid epidemic. We started with people who had been lost a loved one to overdose, and we've expanded it to people who are living in recovery and to first responders and to bringing first responders and people in recovery together, because sometimes there, again, there's a tension. The people in recovery are sometimes treated badly by first responders, and first responders are often feeling pain that they are not able to help and are picking up the same people overdosing again and again. So the goal of this project is to create art and iAudio record them, and then we have multimedia art shows with the art and the audio. You can use a QR code to listen to the stories. I hope you'll go on the Health Story Collaborative website and listen to some. To push back against this narrative here of like addicts are bad people who steal, who are lazy, who are, it's their fault that they're, and to actually just contextualize these human beings and to push against the master narrative that way. So I just, the final clip we're gonna hear and then we're gonna end is Rebecca, who is somebody who participated in a workshop that was people in recovery and first responders together. So let's play Rebecca and then we will close.
Back on June 15th of 2014, I had an overdose on the train and I woke up in a hospital in ICU a few days later. And when I opened my eyes, you know, that scared me because I didn't know where I was. And then on top of it, I'm opiate sick, which I can share, that's like the flu times 1,000. And the doctor just said, you overdose on the train. You're lucky to be alive. You have 8 broken ribs. I'm not giving you any pain medication. And we're going to medically clear you for discharge. And I was discharged from the hospital in a Johnny top in the same shorts that I had peed my pants before the Narcan revived me. I wanted help at that moment, but there was no way I was going to ask. So I ended up coming into recovery 2 days later through the criminal justice system, which I don't promote incarceration for individuals to come into recovery. However, it was something that I needed at that moment. So on June 18th, I had a 2 p.m. violation of probation hearing at Worcester Court. On my way to the court, I end up, you know, using because of like the opiate sickness, even though I didn't wanna, like my body physically wanted it. And the judge said, Rebecca, you know, it looks like you're under the influence and I'm gonna send you to Framingham MCI 7-day detox. And when I came back in front of him 7 days later, out of nowhere, my father stood up in the courtroom and he said, Your Honor, I'm a father, can I say something? And the judge said, absolutely. And he said, if you release my daughter, I'm going to bury her. And the judge sent me back to Framingham prison until they found me a bed in a program. And he said, Rebecca, I'm going to give you another chance because you deserve this. And when you get your 6 months, I want you to come back and I want you to show me. So when I went back, he was in the middle of a trial and he had like a 6-man jury and he said, oh, excuse me for a second. And he got off the bench and he said, Rebecca, come here. And he gave me a big hug. And he said, I'm so proud of you. And he said, when you get your 7 months, I want you to come back and show me. So we did that my first year and it meant the world. And now I'm very close with him. He presents me every year at my support group. So I went to a recovery coach academy and became a peer recovery coach. And I actually had an opportunity for about a year to work in the same ER and meet with people post-overdose where I was brought and being able to change and advocate and educate other medical professionals. The impossible becomes possible.
Because again, we see many of the themes that we talked about, but also I teach medical students and this is one I like to play for them because I remind them, you become a character in other people's stories. And as a provider, you often become an important character potentially, and that has an impact. So we see in this one that the provider was not very nice to her and she couldn't ask for help. And then we see that the judge is really there for her and it makes a difference. So how we show up for people matters. So here are my final key points that I want you to take away from today. We can't always control what happens to us, but we can control how we make meaning out of what happens to us, reflected in the stories that we tell. Every individual is both the main character and the narrator of their own story, and we can decide where to put the chapter breaks. Our stories are not static. We are never stuck. Storytelling is a relational act. You become a character in other people's stories. So how you show up matters. And storytelling can strengthen community and foster positive social change. So we're living in really challenging times. My hope is that you all will feel inspired to engage with your stories and to come together in community to share stories, because I think that is what is going to build bridges and make us stronger. So I'll just end with a quote that is a call to action. It's by Clarissa Pinkola Estes. And she says, one of the most calming and powerful actions you can do to intervene in a stormy world is to stand up and show your soul. Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Brewster, for sharing your story with us today. And hopefully we'll continue to put the word out and share our stories, and for your insightful thoughts on Stories for Health. We do have time for questions from the audience. And for those watching virtually, you may continue to submit your questions by using the live chat section on YouTube. While the ushers collect the yellow cards, let me begin by asking you this question. In your work with patients and families, what has surprised you the most about the healing potential of telling one's story? And what advice would you give to someone who feels their story is too painful or unfinished to share?
Great question. I think, for me, the most surprising thing, as I mentioned, I started with thinking I was creating a listening library, that the listening would be the most powerful piece. But in fact, I think what surprised me at the beginning was how absolutely healing it was, perhaps even more so, for the storyteller to have a platform and to have someone who was engaging with them in a real way and helping them craft their story and put it out there. So just the value of sharing and listening together. I'd say my advice for people who feel like their story is unfinished or too painful, I don't think there's any such thing as too painful a story. I think everyone has to be at a place of readiness to share their story personally, especially if you're going to do so publicly. And no story is ever finished because it's always changing. And so when we share a story, it is the story of that point in time, and it will be different next time we share it. So we don't have to worry about it being finished. And I think sometimes people say to me, I have no story. I don't have an interesting story. Everybody has a story, and there are things that we can relate to that we hear from one another.
Thank you. Okay, first question from the audience. You've acknowledged the value of stories about illnesses of the body. What about stories of illnesses of the mind? For example, anxiety and depression, which are not often accepted by society.
Absolutely. If I made a distinction between physical health and mental health, I did not intend to. Many of our stories that we have done are mental health. And I think it's an artificial distinction. I think there's always both involved in any process. So no, it is absolutely valuable. 2 years ago, our annual event was all around mental health storytelling. You can find that online. It's featuring just the importance of mental health diagnoses and mental health. So it's very important. And all of these tools that I've talked about today and the themes, they apply just the same to mental health as they do to physical health.
Thank you very much. Here's an interesting question. How often do storytellers die after telling their stories? Any data?
I have no data on that. Again, all I'd say to that is, you know, everybody dies, so at some point they do. But we certainly some of our stories have been about people with life-threatening illness, and some of those people have died. But what has inspired me there is just, you know, what Michael's story showed us, that there is always healing that is possible, even when we are dying, and that it's maybe not going to be a redemptive story, but even there could be redemptive themes, like saying what needs to be said or healing relationships that have been broken. So yeah, that's all I'll say. I don't have data on the numbers.
Thank you. Could you please elaborate on the difference between healing and curing, or on the relationship between healing and curing? Thank you.
Yeah, I just think the very most important point there is oftentimes curing is not possible. And curing is what the medical profession is more focused on often, especially in certain fields, of trying to sort of beat illness. There are studies, interestingly, looking at cancer patients and sort of this language of violence and war and fighting. And in fact, that's not always beneficial for us, that language, but it's what we fall to. So there's this sort of fighting mentality, but I think we can't always cure, but we can always heal. And I mean, I say that as someone who lives with a diagnosis where there is no cure yet, but I keep healing every day.
Thank you, Dr. Brewster. My daughter is entering college this fall, majoring in behavioral neuroscience. Do you have any advice to offer her or wisdom in her future endeavors and studies?
Well, I think it's a fantastic field, and I think it is. I think it's a field where we know only a tiny piece of what's possible, and I think it's going to explode in the future with the knowledge that we gain. And I think it's really an exciting field, so I say whatever draws her interest in the field, I think it has great potential. And of course, I'm fascinated in the neurobiology of storytelling, and I'm ready to learn more about that. And as I said, there's more evolving and coming out.
Here's a difficult one. How can one hold the potential of hearing power of storytelling while also holding the truth of an incurable disease?
I mean, I think that's always a part of it if you have an incurable disease, that you always have to hold both of those, all of those different parts. And in fact, as I said, with the accommodative processing, the meaning-making piece, it's actually essential for healing that we engage with the hard parts and sit with those elements of the story. And when I work with people for the Healing Story Session events, John Adler and I are both very aware of sort of the press to redemption that, as he calls it, that exists in our culture, that we love redemptive stories in North America, we do. We want to hear the redemption, but we make a huge effort not to push for redemption, to always dig into the authentic story, because you have to engage with that truth for it to be healing. And that's where the meaning-making piece comes in.
Okay, thank you very much. About the role of the narrator in a story told the physician, is it important for the listening doctor to discern the attitude of the story? Is the narrator self-pitying or genuinely seeking help? Thank you.
That's a tough question, only because I'm thinking of it. Of course, it's important for the provider to try to tap in to what is meaningful to the person and what the story means to that person. Time is a huge constraint in the way that medical system is structured nowadays. So I think it's very hard for patients to really have enough time to tell their stories. And doctors and other providers can certainly do better. I think the data shows we interrupt people within like 11 seconds on average. Mm-hmm. And again, it comes to that, like we're on sort of a detective journey to come up with the answer. So it's like funneling, trying to come up with the answer, rather than listening. So we can do better. I know that I have learned since I have been on the patient side that I try to be more, bring less ego into the room, to be more of a listener, let the story evolve as it's going to. But time is a factor. If you have another patient waiting, just for me, I know I feel that's disrespectful of that person waiting. So you have to, even if you want to spend time, keep moving, and that can be a challenge.
Thank you. In sharing other stories, has HIPAA been an impediment?
No. I mean, as I said, there's a risk management framework in the hospital, and I've had some programming there. For instance, we had like a story kiosk where people could listen, and it was like crazy resistance I had from the hospital to try to get that approved, even though patients were really desiring to tell their stories and share. But of course, everyone's worried about getting sued or HIPAA, but we went through the privacy office and we went through the legal office, and everyone signs a very extensive waiver. And of course, there's no coercion, so I never ask my own patients that I might see in clinic for a completely different reason, because I never want that power dynamic for them to feel any burden to do this. It's up to them, they come to me. So I think, yes, HIPAA is a factor that we think about, obviously, but everyone that I have ever worked with really wants to share their stories. And we always are very much about, like, you sign this waiver, and if you decide after the fact that you don't want to share this publicly, if it wasn't a public event, that's fine. We will rip up the waiver. The most important thing for me is that it's an empowering experience for the storyteller, and I start with the patient. I've had this tension working with the media over the years, who always want, like, the most dramatic thing that can feel exploitative, and for me, it's been, I am most committed to making it an empowering healing experience for the storyteller above all else, and I honor that.
Okay, thank you. Do you work with the judicial system? Rebecca's story should be played for lawyers and judges.
I do not work for the judicial system, but I think just important to remember for that study I quoted about the judicial system is that, just to say, like, stories do a much better job convincing people of things and helping people communicate across difference. And, you know, sometimes the reaction is, oh, we need all the facts and statistics to actually move the needle. And it's the opposite is true. We need the stories.
Okay. Is there an insurance billing code for empathy? ? And how do we get one established?
That one I'm going to put back to you. I wish there was.
I wish, that's right.
Yeah, I wish.
Unfortunately, no, there isn't. But we certainly all need more time with our clinicians from an empathetic standpoint. Does your organization seek compatible listeners?
We seek all types of listeners. We want you to come and engage with the website. It's just healthstorycollaborative.org. We have a newsletter where you'll see about our upcoming events. We always have events that are open to the public. We have an online storytelling event coming up in August. And it's called Finding Unconditional Peace. So check out the website. We would love people to listen and to share and engage in whatever way you can. We rely on people like you.
Okay. I broke my back 2 years ago. I've been complaining ever since, and I want to develop a more positive attitude. How do I do that effectively?
Wow, that's hard. I mean, pain is so hard, and I have so much empathy for pain. I think it's really hard to be nice and positive when you feel in pain. But I think some of this, I really believe, sharing with other people, talking about it, can help ease that pain. Sharing our stories with other people who are navigating similar things, building community. But I think I never want people to feel judged for sharing their pain, because we have to acknowledge what's hard and horrible, and sometimes it just stinks. But, you know, for me, like, sometimes I do things like just a gratitude practice, like writing down 3 things I feel, which could be my cup of coffee. You know, it could be a tiny thing, but that helps me stay positive. And just, again, I never want to be sort of like pushing people to say it's all wonderful. It's not. But where I came to in my life is, what's the alternative? This is what is before me. This is the choice that I have. And I play some role in deciding how that's going to go. And to me, that feels empowering.
Do we have time for more questions? Okay. This is a difficult one. Do you feel believing you are given another life after nearly giving up life due to health is the best route?
Can you repeat that for me?
Do you feel believing you are given another life after nearly giving up life due to health is the best route?
I don't think I'd say best, worst. Again, I'd say it's a choice we're making. It's always really challenging, but it is also an opportunity to think about new beginnings or find a new purpose. For me, I'll say that I found new purpose out of this. I wouldn't have wanted this diagnosis, but it has helped me bring together my personal experience with caring for my patients the way that I want to care for them. And it's allowed me to develop the themes in my own life that are healing to me while also helping other people do that. So it's given me tremendous meaning. So for me, that's an opportunity. And so I think always just looking for the opportunities is all we can do.
Thank you, Dr. Brewster. And we'll close our questions at this time. I appreciate you sharing your time and your expertise with us today. We hope you have enjoyed today's presentation of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Thank you for your support of our 2025 season. Please join us next week to hear Jonah Wheeler talking about demystifying state and local government. Now please join us for an informal reception in the parish hall through the door to my right. There you will have the opportunity to engage in further conversation with our speaker and to enjoy light snacks and cold drinks. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.